Hello and welcome to Volume 129 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about using fire and hardwood. We'll discuss pine straw production with one who actually does it. And we'll talk about year-end planning. And we'll also talk about why there's an oversupply of pine sawtimber. This program is brought to you by the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you're facing as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. We're technically no longer in the Great Recession, but its effects linger in the pine sawtimber markets in the Southeast, and there's really no better person to discuss this with than Brooks Mendel, CEO of Forest Consulting. Welcome back, Brooks.
Thank you, Hayes.
How did the Great Recession lead to a pine sawtimber accumulation in the South?
The recession was really part of a story that has three parts to it. In the 80s and the 90s, we had the CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program, that helped get a lot of acres into pine trees. And then the second part was during the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, intensive forest management increased, and we were using better seedlings. And all this better growth and technology walked right into the recession, which led to less demand for homes and lumber, which caused less harvesting, which let trees grow out there, and they accumulated to create this big supply.
How does this accumulation of pine sawtimber affect the way forests are managed in the South?
It's interesting because the recession hasn't led to that much change in the way forests are managed. We know this because we do big silviculture surveys every year in the South or the Northwest, and we're tracking about 34 million acres now. And what we found is forest owners, a lot of them have been patient, and they're making small changes on the margin, not massive changes. And the small changes include examples like doing some moves from two thinning regimes to single thinning regimes. And they're spending a lot more time just trying to make sure their forest management and silviculture is either, you know, soil appropriate and site appropriate, so they're not wasting or spending more money than they need to get the trees they want.
Okay. And let's talk about the people. How's the accumulation of pine saw timber affected the timberland and the mill investors in the South?
So this has been pretty interesting, right? This is where a lot of the action is it has affected where people deploy their capital. And especially, you can really see it in the mills, because all the trees and the forests that we have in the South have really been a magnet for wood users to come to the South. And I'll give you just a couple very brief examples from the past 2 years, because when you look at what's going on in the rest of North America, I mean, just in this year alone, 2019 alone, in Western Canada and British Columbia, they've closed five more sawmills, softwood sawmills, because they don't have the trees. And then those companies are relocating to the South. And if you just look at Alabama, we have several examples from the past 2 years and places that are being built now that will open up next year. And you can just look at like GP in Talladega or Sunbelt in Selma, and Westervelt's building a mill in Thomasville, and the Rex Lumber in Troy. I mean, these are all in state, and it's a good example of how these trees and these forests have let these firms move their mills, and they're sort of just priming the pump to get ready as demand continues to increase moving forward.
Okay. Well, thank you for that analysis, Brooks. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks, Dave.
Using prescribed fire is a common practice in pine forests, but what you may not know is that you can also use prescribed fire in upland hardwood forests. Callie Schweitzer can help us understand how this works. Hello, Callie.
Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Why would somebody use fire as a management tool in upland hardwood?
So, a lot of commonly given reasons for using fire in upland hardwoods really has to do with creating a certain type of a habitat. And it certainly has those benefits to create specific habitat if that's your goal. It certainly will reduce the understory vegetation and brush, and those open conditions are very conducive to more herbaceous, a flush of herbaceous. But there's also some myths about why we use fire in our upland hardwood system. Sometimes we say that we're reducing fuel loading. And although there may be an ephemeral or temporary decrease in the fuels that are out there, which are the little twigs and the leaves and needles and stuff, for the most part, our fuels are in much more in balance in our upland hardwood system. So what we have in decomposition sort of is replenished with leaf fall, and that cycle continues pretty much in balance. So that's a little bit of a myth. Another myth for using fire is that it will promote oak in particular. It's a highly desired species. I spent my whole career studying it. And that's really a depending whether it will help with oak regeneration or not. A more novel reason might be to restore a natural process that has been removed from these systems. And so I like to tell people that, you know, if you want more nature-based management, putting fire through your upland hardwoods is a way to get back to that process that has been removed.
What goals that a forest landowner might have can be promoted with using a fire in hardwood?
Now, using fire in hardwoods really depends on the conditions. In our hardwood stands, our conditions even across the stand can be highly variable. We have a different species mix. We have a lot of topography changes and so forth. And so fire intensity and fire duration and even the return interval really affect the types of goals that can be addressed. But in general, like one fire can certainly decrease some of the understory vegetation. We will have a result of a lot of copious sprouting of our hardwood stems, and so we often need to have multiple fires to have an impact on the midstory or smaller trees in the understory. It certainly will temporarily increase browse if that's a goal. And this flush of herbaceous species that's also associated with higher quality habitat attributes. There is an ephemeral reduction in some fine fuels, the small stuff out there. But the take home is that the benefit to oak over other competing species is really not that certain.
Real quickly, do you have any precautions or a word of caution about using fire in upland hardwoods?
So I do. It really all goes back to the landowner's management goals. If your goal is to grow quality hardwood timber, the use of fire in these stands is certainly can increase the potential to increase degrade or defect in the most valuable part of the tree, which is the lower bole. Fire behavior is very hard to predict. Fire is a very imprecise tool, a very blunt tool. We have very few days that we are in prescription, especially in our hardwood forest, the types of burns that we like to get in there. And so we're very limited in that way. Fire behavior, the fuel dispersion, weather, stand structure and composition, all these things influence the result to stand dynamics after a fire. So I really would encourage landowners to speak to their managers and people that are talented in putting fire through a system to know what kind of desired response you want and talk about what kind of fire you can get. So we really need to be clear about the kind of fire that's needed in a stand under your stand conditions that will meet your goals, and make sure that fire is the best tool to achieve that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Callie. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
David Scherer is a landowner who harvests and sells pine straw off his own land. He's got a wealth of personal knowledge on how pine straw production works. Welcome, David.
Good morning, Hayes. How are you?
Tell us how, if you have a pine plantation that you're managing, how it would differ if you're using pine straw production versus just pure timber management.
It's a completely different mindset. You actually want to focus in your long-term goals actually be pine straw production. And you want to maximize your profit and the revenue generation from the pine straw, but keep in mind that all the management treatments, your herbicide applications, your burns, mechanical mowing, other mechanical treatments, they all increase your actual timber growth. So whenever that stand rotation, you do get to your final cut, you're still going to get that you know, your chipping saw and your poles and all the other timber products, but you're in the interim, you're going to have all that pine straw revenue before that.
So you're kind of saying go all in, right?
Yes, yes. Maximize your some, you know, some people they're looking at, okay, well, I want to thin at 15 and increase your growth. Normal timber stand management, you do that. But for pine straw, you're going to lose a lot of pine straw production during that thinning. So say it's 3 or 5% that you lose not doing that thinning at 15, and then you go to 20 or maybe even 30 year rotation. You're going to make, you know, 100-200% more revenue from that, say 100 acres versus the thinning. So it makes sense to prioritize the pine straw production.
You mentioned rotation length. What's the rotation length for pine straw?
I would say probably at a minimum 20 years, more like 25, 30. We're going to run past 30 years. Like I said, we're getting the yearly income that's going to equal or exceed the timber value at the final cut, but then you're going to get the final cut on top of that pine straw revenue. So
okay.
that's one of the different mindsets that you have to keep in mind. It's totally different from a normal timber management, you know, plan and, you know, the long-term view.
People want to know how many bales per acre a long lease stand can produce. What's your view?
The kind of the industry standard is the 35-pound bigger round bales, and they're getting anywhere from 200 to 300 bales. I've got the smaller balers, and I'm averaging 350-ish. Some of my better areas, I'm getting 400-plus bales per acre.
Okay, what you said was for a 35-pound bale, which is the round one, 200 to 300 is a reasonable goal.
Yes.
That's the number of bales per acre. Okay. And then what's the market
What's
the market like in Alabama for pine straw now?
It is wide open. I am booked up. I have people calling me every year looking for pine straw. One big factor is Hurricane Michael came up through Panama City and Mexico Beach last year and wiped out several thousand acres of pure pine straw production land down there. There's guys that were producing straw, had 800,000, however many acres. They didn't even, it was so much trouble to get cleaned up and get back into it. They're not returning to the industry. They're just going to broker or whatever. So it's wide open. And most of the straw that's sold in Alabama is coming from out of state.
Oh, okay. All right. So there's some opportunity for growth. Thank you, David. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
We're nearing year end, and that's a good time to think proactively about year end tax planning. We're pleased to have Orman Wilson, a CPA from Jameson Money Farmer, to help us think about this topic. Hello, Orman.
Good morning, Hayes.
At this point in the year, what can I do tax wise if I'm in the timber business or I'm a timber investor?
Okay, the first thing I would recommend is everybody be in the timber business. It just gives you a little more advantage. If you are in the timber business, you can make a 631B election for the sale of any timber. This allows you to report the timber proceeds on Form 4797. It's treated as ordinary income, which makes it not subject to the net investment income tax of 3.8%. But the beauty of it is it allows you to transfer it to Schedule D for a capital gains tax. So it could range from zero tax up to 20% tax, but you still avoid the net investment income tax. Now, you don't have to be in the timber business. You can also be a timber investor to take advantage of reforestation expenses. And, of course, these expenses, everybody knows, it's site prep, the cost for the seeds or seedlings, any labor, tools used. You can even depreciate the equipment that's used to do the reforestation. With the law change, you can now deduct $10,000 per qualified timber property. And while that's a boon, if you have a large tract, you could actually subdivide it into two separate tracts, maybe three separate tracts. You could spend up to, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, whatever, and it's still deductible for the year. If you have a large tract that you really can't divide, it's all pine, no stream running through it, no fencing, whatever, I would recommend if you're going to have to spend more than $10,000 on that particular tract, I would spend $10,000 in December and then come back in January and spend the additional amount to reforest.
Okay. Let's talk about deductions. The standard deduction was increased with the last tax bill, but how can I minimize itemized deductions? And do you have any other final suggestions?
Okay. In addition to the standard deduction being increased to $24,400 by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, state and local taxes are now capped at $10,000 annually. Basically, all your 2% miscellaneous itemized deductions are gone. What I would do is what we call bunching. And if you're a charitable person and you're giving so much money each year to your favorite charities, your church, whatever, you might want to wait. And instead of making all these donations in December, you might want to wait, make that same donation in January of the next year, then make your normal donations in December of the same year. That way you're bunching your charitable contributions. It might put you over the standard deduction. I would also do the same thing with my medical expenses. Anything that you can delay doing this year, wait and do all your medical procedures the following year so that do it the same year you're doing your charitable contributions. That way you can take advantage of both of them.
Okay. Oh, okay. That's some good suggestions. Thank you, Orman. We appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Brooks Mandel, Callie Schweitzer, David Scherer, and Orman Wilson. One of the joys of owning timberland is the variety of things your land can do for you. It's really hard to think of an investment that can open up so many different opportunities for you than forest land. Forest land can be thought of as an investment to complement things like stocks and fixed income investments. It can be operated at a low annual cost, around 1% or even less. But forest land also can be an opportunity to try new things, to explore bird watching, hunting, learning about plants, to experience the effects of prescribed fire on the landscape. And forests can also be a reinforcement of family history and values, can be a way to reinforce what your family's all about and who has contributed to making the family forest available to you. That's a lot of value from a forest, and it's the gift that keeps on giving. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.